Welcome, everybody, to episode 10 of Podcasting Them Softly. I am here with my BFF podcasting soulmate, Nick Clement. How's it going, Nick?
What's going on, Frank?
Oh, not too much. So this week, we're very excited because we're going to be discussing Scorsese's Gangs of New York, which is a film that I loved since I first saw it when it was in theaters. I've been beating the drum for this film for years, forever. It catches a lot of flack because it's flawed, and yeah, it's flawed, but I think it's Scorsese's masterpiece. He's been trying to get the movie made since the 70s. Whatever, we'll get into that. We're also going to be discussing the top five performances of Daniel Day-Lewis, who's featured as the main character of the film. I think he's the main character, even though Leo gets top billing and it's kind of structured around Leo in a way. I don't know. Yeah, we're doing Daniel Day-Lewis, obviously, who is my favorite actor of all time, living or dead. And we're also going to be doing Meryl Streep because we did Cameron Diaz last week with The Counselor, and she's really the only prominent female in the cast of Gangs of New York. So yeah, we have that. I just want to say real quick before we jump in that I just want to say a huge thank you to Mark Pellington for coming on our podcast and discussing his filmography and his process as an artist. And it was just fantastic to have him on. Nick and I both love Mark Pellington and his work. It was incredible. I mean, it was truly incredible and humbling to have him on. And he was so gracious with us and spent a lot of time talking with us. So that was fantastic. I know a lot of people enjoyed it who listened to it. Not going to do any name drops here, but we have a lot of guests that we are going to have lined up throughout the next couple months. And it's very, very, very exciting. And they're very good filmmakers. So that's going to be fantastic. And we will drop more information as we go along, or we're just going to drop it like we dropped the Pellington piece. Either way, you guys are in for a treat, as are Nick and myself, because we're going to be talking to some really amazing people. So let's just move right into Gangs of New York. Gangs of New York came out in 2003. Right?
Yeah. As far as I know, it came out in 2002, and it was like...
Okay, it came out in 2002.
Yeah, which is my... Yeah, I remember because it was the first year I was living out in L.A.
That was the year before I graduated high school, so...
Wow.
Yeah, so it came out in 2002. It is this gigantic scope of a film. It is epically large, and it's... packs a lot of stuff into it with its near 3-hour runtime. I know there was originally a longer cut, which I don't think we'll ever see, but I would love to see the 4.5 hour cut or whatever, however long the length of that is. What it's about is it takes place pre-Civil War, right at like the brink of the Civil War when the draft gets initiated. That's kind of a underlying scope of the film, but really what it's about is about the 5 points in New York City, and it's essentially about organized crime also. It's this great huge film that deals with anti-war themes, themes of immigration, themes of organized crime, and themes of what it is to be an American and what America is. It's interesting because Scorsese packs this all in, and it's a very important historical film too, even though it's built around, like, the Daniel Day-Lewis character, Bill the Butcher, is based on a real character. There's a lot of important facts to this. Okay, I'll just get into the brief synopsis of it then. Real quick. The movie starts out with this amazing fight sequence that's between the gangs of the Dead Rabbits, which is led by Liam Neeson, that they all hang out in this gigantic church. And the opening sequence of the film is fantastic, with Liam Neeson shaving and young Leonardo DiCaprio watching his father prepare for battle. And they walk through this half-built, run-down, worn-out church with all this stuff happening around them, with people preparing for battle, people getting into fights. It's this gigantic melting pot. And they come out to the Five Point Square, which is essentially the town square of this section of New York where they're at, and they're going to fight the Confederation of American Natives, which is led by Daniel Day-Lewis, who plays Bill the Butcher Cutting, which is one of the greatest characters I've ever seen on screen. Bill the Butcher is just the greatest thing ever. And this battle is just ferocious, and it's violent, and it's disturbing. And Scorsese slows the camera down to 12 frames per second, and this battle is incredibly jarring and shaky. It's handheld cam, 12 frames per second, and it's queued up to Peter Gabriel's Signal to Noise, which is this very ambient and eerie and also escalating musical number. And it's fantastic, and what ends up happening is Bill the Butcher kills Priest Valen, who's played by Liam Neeson. The Butcher takes control of the Five Points. Flash forward 15 years later, and Leonardo DiCaprio comes back to the Five Points after he leaves his boarding school or orphanage, wherever he's at, orphanage, and he comes back and essentially finds Bill, becomes Bill's shadow, gets mentored by Bill with the subversion of avenging his father's death and killing Bill. And while all this is happening, there's a plethora of character actors that are fantastic in the film. They're, like I mentioned earlier, there's the theme of anti-war with the Civil War aspect going on, and you know, racism and all sorts of stuff. It's a fantastic film. The problem with it is it's unbalanced and it's flawed, and it has nothing to do with the aesthetics of the film, because the production value is insane. And the costume design is insane. And the set design. I mean, there's no CGI. Well, maybe for the final sequence.
Yeah, there's some Vista CGI stuff. You know, like background drop and, you know, augmentation.
Right, but the Battle of the Five limited. Points, that's all on the set. I mean, that's a set
specifically for this
film.
The CGI is kept very limited throughout the film. I mean, it's staggering what was done practically.
Right, and another thing that I think is fascinating about this film is that no one owns a Scorsese movie except Scorsese. I don't care if it's Taxi Driver or Raging Bull or King of Comedy or Goodfellas. Scorsese always owns his films, and what I think makes Gangs of New York so unique is this is Daniel Day-Lewis's film. It's as if Scorsese just pulled the ripcord on Day-Lewis and just let him run with everything, because he gives one of the best performances I've ever seen in my entire life. He is just unhinged and out of control. And the problem with that is, and this is where I think the flaws come in, it's not necessarily that the story's weak or the screenplay's weak or anything of that. My issue with the film is, one, I hate to bag on your girl, but I think Cameron Diaz is miscast in this film. I don't think she does a good job. I think she's in over her head with working with Scorsese and having to share scenes with Day-Lewis. And then my other issue is Leonardo DiCaprio. I love DiCaprio. I think he's a fantastic actor. I love that this movie is what started the bromance between DiCaprio and Scorsese, and they went on to make Aviator, The Departed, Wolf of Wall Street, and I think DiCaprio is flawless in those films. I just don't think at this point in his career he was quite ready to go toe-to-toe with Day-Lewis. And an example I'll pull out is There Will Be Blood with Day-Lewis and Paul Dano. I think Paul Dano's a great actor, and I think he holds his own quite well against Day-Lewis. And not that I think DiCaprio's bad in the movie. I don't think he's bad. I think his accent may get annoying at some parts, but I just don't like Amsterdam that much in the film. I think I've seen this movie more than most people have seen it, and the way I look at it might be kind of skewed because I look through it through different guys. I think I kind of look at Bill as the anti-hero in a way in this film. I don't look at him as like a full-out villain. I look at Bill as this undying patriot who has this blinding love for America, and well, maybe not so much America, but the concept he sees as America and what America should be, because he's definitely villain-esque, but at the same time, as the movie progresses, there's different references to Priest Valen and how much respect he holds for Valen. I mean, there's the picture of him in Bill's butcher shop above the mantle where those candles are and everything. And even when Bill kills Valen at the beginning of the film, like the battle's over as soon as Bill kills him. And he has the utmost respect for Valen. I guess the more I talk this out and think about other aspects of the film, especially with Brendan Gleeson's character, Bill might be more of a villain than an anti-hero. But do you see what I'm saying with this? Like, I think when it comes to the conclusion of the film, when it's the showdown between Amsterdam and Bill, how far do we want to go with this? I would assume most people have seen this film, so we can talk about the ending, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess before we get to the ending, I mean, I agree with you in the sense that that he does feel more like an anti-hero than an outright villain. It's odd. I saw this movie in the theater 3 times, as I recall. I actually went on the night of the Oscars after it lost. Because I just wanted to see.
Oh, just to interject, not to cut you off here, but I just got to say I was fucking irate when Day-Lewis didn't win and Scorsese didn't win and this didn't win Best Picture. I mean, I love Chicago. I love Seabiscuit. I think that was a great year for film. I'm probably more so upset about the fact that Adrian Brody won the Oscar over Day-Lewis for Day-Lewis's performance in this film. I mean, The Pianist is great, right? Adrian Brody's a really good actor, but I mean, come on, man. Look, Scorsese and DiCaprio went to Italy to go meet with Day-Lewis to talk him out of his retirement, where he was a cobbler. I mean, they brought him back to cinema. If this movie never happened or got made, I don't know if Day-Lewis would have ever acted again. And I'm not saying this should be all thrown up when he was up for his Academy Award, but I mean, bottom line, dude, come on. Scorsese's been shafted his entire career, and you can say what you want about The Departed. I think The Departed's very good, but I don't think it's that movie that should have won everything for Scorsese, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, rarely does anybody, I mean, listen, I think that I personally have no, I could care less about the Oscars. I think that they're a joke.
I
don't think that they have any bearing in terms of what a great movie is. It's a popularity in a politically motivated group that votes for their friends in weird ways. Nobody ever wins.
But
nobody ever wins for the performance or for the film that they've directed that they really should win for. It's a known thing. I mean, you could look at all of the people who've won throughout the years.
Yeah, but come on. I mean, Day-Lewis is the only actor to have 3 Best Actor Oscars in the history of the Academy. And I mean, I think that's pretty fucking dead on. The guy should have.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that they don't pick.
But, I mean, whatever.
I'm not saying that they don't pick great stuff from time to time. I'm not saying that they haven't honored great performances and great movies. What I'm saying is that, especially as the years have gone on, I feel that the choices are familiar and way safe, and I just don't hold any stock in the Academy Awards. That being said,
right.
You know, in terms of Scorsese and everybody's, you know, job, yeah, I'm just not really sure. I've never really seen all of the beefs that a lot of people have had with this movie. I got a chance to see it a bunch of times in the theater when I was living out in LA, and I loved it every time. I guess my biggest thing is that I would like to see more of it. The work print that everybody seems to be talking about, and which came up today online in some of the comments on the piece that I posted, which was illuminating, it sounds as if there's 20 minutes extra footage in this work print, quote unquote, that has found its way out into the public, and some people have a copy of this. And it sounds like there was some restructuring done. There was elimination of voiceover. The end was a little bit different in terms of some shot selection. I mean, you'd love to see it. I just think this movie is incredible. It's massive. You're not going to see an evocation of another year or another era like that again in the big screen without a ton of CGI. Dante Ferretti's production design, and just when I was watching it last night on Blu-ray, it just really struck me as just something completely overwhelming. And the screenplay is just a constantly shifting piece that is so dense, and there's so much going on that even when I've watched it now 5 or 6 times, I feel myself sort of learning new things as I go along.
And right.
It's an impossible film to sort of digest on one viewing or two viewings. It's a film that really, you know, involves you on multiple levels. I mean, I think it's clear, obviously, that Daniel Day-Lewis owns the movie, and he's the magnetic force that's sort of pulling everybody towards the center of the film. And, you know, Cameron Diaz, who I'm, as much as I love, I completely agree with you. She's sort of way out of her depth in terms of everybody that's around her. I still think that she gave it her all. I don't think that it was for a lack of trying or for a lack of passion, but I just think that she struggled with the accent clearly. And, you know, you had brought up the interesting point about how, and I don't know if this is something that you had read online that maybe was there any truth to what you're talking about Colin Farrell? Or was that just a sort of desire, a personal desire?
No, that's my thing. Right after I saw the film, and even to this day when I watch it, I think that Colin Farrell would have been the ideal Amsterdam Valen. I think that not just because he's Irish, but that definitely helps. But I think that the character of Amsterdam is more along the lines of what Farrell's range is than what DiCaprio's range was at the time. And even now, I mean, Wolf of Wall Street, Aviator, even The Departed, DiCaprio is perfect for that.
And don't forget about Shutter Island.
Yeah, okay, Shutter Island. Yeah,
I think he's perfect for. And
I love him. I love him in Shutter Island. I mean, I think he's a fucking great actor. I just feel like this period piece is just perfectly suited for what Farrell could bring. I think that...
And that would have been interesting because at that point, Farrell had way less experience than DiCaprio. And Farrell had just gotten discovered at that point with Tigerland. So he, like, that was like a couple years, like that was probably what, 2000, Tigerland, 2001?
When Phone Booth came out.
Yeah, Phone Booth came out, I'm trying to remember exactly, the early 2000s. So he was sort of, you know, an untested commodity. Like, I doubt the studio would have been like, yeah, sure, like, go with Colin Farrell. I don't think that he wouldn't have meant anything from, like, that's why Cameron Diaz was cast, is because they knew that if they put Cameron Diaz and Leonardo DiCaprio together, that's two hot actors at the moment. We got to put them together, and that's going to justify, you know, the $100 million expense for a period piece that's going to be so violent. You know,
exactly. You know. I mean, at that point in time, Day-Lewis, I mean, to serious film watchers, everybody knew that Day-Lewis being in this, his second collaboration with Scorsese, it was going to be epic. But I mean, at the time, to the mass audiences, no one really knew who Daniel Day-Lewis was. He doesn't have the stigma he does now. I mean, I think Lincoln really was like, whoa. That was probably the broadest audience, I would imagine that Day-Lewis got to. Well, I'm sure he did with Gangs of New York, but you know what I mean? He didn't really kind of hold. I don't know if he has box office draw now. I would think he probably does, or I should say has a lot more box office draw than he did in 2002. Because, I mean, face it, I mean, the guy was pretty much retired and didn't really care to act anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Scorsese and DiCaprio got on a plane to Italy and kind of willed it out of him. I can't imagine anybody else who could have played Bill. I mean, bottom line, I don't know who else could have done that, honestly. I think that with most any Day-Lewis performance, I don't know. Sure, maybe a couple of them could be interchangeable with somebody else, but, I mean, who else would have played Bill? Like De Niro? No. Willem Dafoe? Maybe.
Well, De Niro and Willem Dafoe both were involved in this project. I don't know what roles they were looked at for, but they both had to leave because of the delays. And I don't know what roles they would have been up for. Do you?
I would imagine the butcher.
I guess I read online that both of them were in discussions for roles, but both had to, you know, to go their separate ways. I mean, this movie is just, it's so big. It's Scorsese's, like, it's his maximalist film. I mean, it's just, there's
right.
So many scenes of chaos, of people screaming, of fighting, of rioting, of huge emotions, huge violence, big showboating performances. I mean,
right.
it felt like sort of Scorsese's his ode in a way to cinema up to that point. And it definitely sort of marked an interesting turning point for him, because he really got into the epics and really got into these large scale, large canvas movies that he wasn't necessarily known for. I mean, like, you know, obviously Age of Innocence was big, and Kundun, you know, was also rather epic, but
right,
you know,
Last
more,
Temptation of Christ.
Yeah, really known for the down and dirty, the intimate, you know, gangster stuff and the New York milieu and the whole thing. So I think that the modern New York milieu, but this is a movie that he was born to make. Clearly, you could see his filmmaking passion. I mean, the opening 10-15 minutes is just some of the most extraordinary filmmaking that I've ever seen. The march of the dead rabbits all the way through the tunnel, where, like you said, you're exposed to this massive, you know, melting pot of all these people that have come to New York and are trying to figure themselves out, and you have that extraordinary shot, that pullback where you see the housing structure, and you see all the people going about their business and flipping out on each other and, you know, living in squalor. And it just took
chaos.
You to that time. It's just chaos. And he took you to that time and he took you to that place. And there was never any sort of, there was no coddling with any of this movie. It's big. There's a ton of speaking roles, and, you know, your hand really isn't held too much. I mean, you know, some people have complained about the voiceover and talked about how the voiceover was a crutch and how it helped guide the story, and
not
it wasn't
really,
you know, but I've always loved how Scorsese's used voiceover. He's one of the few directors,
yeah,
in my opinion, that's used it so well consistently and knows how to use it. I'd be curious to see this work print, because I gather the voiceover is gone, I think, based on what I've read, if I'm not getting myself mixed up.
That's what I've read too.
Just the violence in this movie is something else. Watching it last night, I had completely forgotten about how bloody and how intense. I mean, a literal river of blood at the end when people are like walking through it. This got to be Scorsese's goriest movie, right? I mean,
I would say so. I mean, what?
Yeah.
I mean, you got Goodfellas that has a couple of scenes.
Yeah, Casino has a lot of violence, and Casino has a lot of violence in that last 20 minutes. That's, you know, the roundup of all the guys,
right,
you know.
But I mean, at the end of the film, when, you know, the U.S. Navy turns its warships on New York City because of the draft riots.
Yeah,
and how many sequences are there of the cannons going off and the cannonballs just landing in the middle of the street and just blowing people apart? And just like you said, man, the river of blood, and then the final confrontation of DiCaprio and Bill, and when he gets when Bill gets the knife pulled out of his stomach and the blood sprays all over DiCaprio's
face.
It's amazing.
Scorsese's loved violence forever. He's been fascinated with it. I mean, there's nothing more, as sad as it is to say, there's very little that can be as exciting or as exhilarating in movies as movie violence. It's just part of the deal. I mean, it's why people have been attracted to it for so long. And he's a guy that's really gotten to an understanding of it, I think, and knows how to give it power even when it's over the top. None of it ever feels it's odd. It's incredibly
gratuitous.
It's unbelievably bloody, but at the same time, none of it ever feels gratuitous because there's an honesty in a way and an integrity to all of it that cuts through the savagery. And keep in mind, this movie's sort of the backbone of this ridiculous screenplay. I mean, and you have to mention their names because it's like, when will you see the names Steven Zaillian, Kenneth Lonergan, and Jay Cox ever lined up together again? It's never going to happen. And that represents three such strong voices that independently do very different things with their writing. And, this film it's packed with incident and people and places and things. And it's to say nothing of the end, that the amazing time lapse that goes on and the ultimate, middle finger to terrorism with keeping the Trade Center in there. I mean, in retrospect, how ballsy of a move a year after 9/11, where everyone is still reeling from it and is still messed up from it, right? The psyche's been shattered. People are fucked up from it, and you've made this weirdly cathartic, violent, sort of opus, a New York movie, and then you end your film because I mean, think about it. If you were going to tell he had every right to not show the towers because when the movie was made, they were gone and he was showing modern New York, but he was like, fuck you, man. I'm putting the fucking towers in there. They're going to stand up. They're going to be there because that's my New York. That's Scorsese's New York. And, I just, it sort of struck me as the same way at the end, 4 years later, Steven Spielberg had his chance to sort of give the middle finger in Munich, to everybody, because, considering that Munich is all about inherent violence and, man's ability to continuously inflict violence. And again, getting back to Gangs in New York, the theme of revenge, I mean, the classic theme of revenge that is at the core of this movie that drives so many, compelling narratives throughout cinema. This movie knows revenge up the wazoo. I mean, it knows exactly how to pull the, screw you, sort of needle you in the right way, to get you excited for when he's going to face off against, Bill the Butcher at the end. It's just, I love this movie. You could say one thing about this thing. It could have been different. You could have done this. You could have cast her. You could have cast him. It is what
it
is.
But I like it as it is.
And I just, for me, it's just, it's huge. And it's a, and it represents filmmaking that, when are they going to go out? Who's the filmmaker now that's going to get a chance to have all of that built for real again out in Cinecittà Studios in Rome? Who's going to command that? Who's going to get a chance to do that now that everything's done in a freaking computer?
Right. Scorsese, man. I mean, to bring up a few points of what you were saying when you were talking about the gratuitous violence, and we talked about the ending and the draft riots with the... I mean, and that's important. I don't want to get too carried away because I'm trying to remember all the points I want to make, but this film is definitely anti-war, and it came out at an interesting time. It came out post 9/11. It came out rah, 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 the Iraq War. I think the theme of anti-war is one of the strongest in this film, because it was written during the 70s. That's when it was originally conceived, and Scorsese wanted to make it, and it took him till 2002 to get it out of him. And I mean, this is the only time in American history where, the military attacked its own citizens. It wasn't the Reds versus the Blue. It wasn't the Confederates versus the Union. It was the American Navy turning its cannons onto the chaos of the 5 points and the draft riots. I mean, I think that's an important part of this film. But to get to the gratuitous violence that you were talking about, yes, I mean, Scorsese loves violence. I mean, he loves violence. He loves violence like Tarantino loves violence. And I think that there is a companion between Tarantino's filmmaking and Scorsese's filmmaking. But to bring up the opening sequence, we kind of skipped over that when we were talking about the violence of the film. I mean, Jesus, man. I mean, people's cheeks are getting ripped open.
Yeah, you've got a lady. You've got a lady biting off some guy's ear.
Right. I mean, Hellcat Maggie. Yeah, she's biting off people's ears, and other people are getting fish hooked. I mean, holy God, man.
Well, yeah, no guns. It was bring everything but your gun.
Right.
And it's just like it's so ridiculous. You know, when that great line when he says no guns, good boy. You know, I love that. When you know, it's just and you got it. You have to say, could there been? I mean. Was there one line of bad dialogue given to Daniel Day-Lewis? I mean, like, obviously not, right? But
no.
Every single line that they gave him is incredible. It's like
every single line that Day-Lewis has is absolute gold. And I mean, you know, to bring up Pellington last week when he talked about, you know, anytime somebody tells him he made a great film, he said it was a great script. It all comes down to the script. You can't make something. You can't make something great if it's not on the page. And I firmly believe that. And I think that this is a perfect representation of that. I mean, think about all the iconic lines in this film. I mean, with Day-Lewis, oh, you could just quote him like, this is a night for America or a night for Americans.
The scene when he's draped in the American flag after they've had their debauchery, after he saved his life. I mean, that one scene is just like, it's like a masterclass of everything, of timing, of how you handle yourself in the scene, how you look off into the distance. I mean, like, it's everything's so perfect. He really is on another level, and, you know, there's...
And his over-the-top New York accent? Holy God. I mean, Jesus. You know, Daniel Day-Lewis is probably one of the actors that I could probably list the actors on one hand that... I never see Daniel Day-Lewis. I know it's him. I mean, obviously I know it's him, but you never see him. He gets – you want to talk about method acting? Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
This guy just gets so immersed. And I love reading – we'll get into the method acting with Day-Lewis when we cover his top five. But, I mean, I love reading all the stories of, like, the behind the scenes of Day-Lewis staying in character throughout the entire production of the film. I mean, it's insane. But – one of the other things I wanted to bring up, you brought up 9/11 and Scorsese keeping the Twin Towers in at the end of the movie. I firmly believe that the two most important post 9/11 films that have come out, even to this day, I mean, I'm sure people argue other ones and you may have your own opinion on this, but certainly I think Gangs of New York is one of them. The other one I think that's probably the most important is 25th Hour, the Spike Lee film that was essentially the first film to shoot in New York City post 9/11, and the themes of 9/11 and what happened with 9/11 completely makes that movie what it is. But yeah, Gangs of New York.
And I would love to tell you just real quick. I'll jump in. I 100% agree with you. The 25th Hour I think is a masterpiece. I think that it's more Spike. I think it's one of Spike Lee's best movies, if not his best movie that I've ever seen. It's certainly my favorite. And I had a chance to see that in Los Angeles in a packed theater to a very mixed response. I remember the theater. It was like a weird feeling after that movie was done. It was like half the place loved it and half the place hated it. I think it's incredible. And you're absolutely right. It was one of the first movies to directly address 9/11 head on. I mean, they had those eerie shots of Ground Zero with Terrence Blanchard's haunt score in the beginning. I'll never forget any of it. I've seen it multiple times, you know, the scene in the bathroom with Ed Norton flipping out about, you know, New York and people in general is an all timer. And that movie really just hit a raw nerve that was still open and just raw as hell. And I agree. I mean, Gangs of New York is very similar in many respects in the way that it sort of approaches the intensity of feeling, and to come out at that time, you know, it was just such a unique time for people. I mean, I remember, you know, it's
well,
one
it was
of those
delayed,
things.
Right?
Well, yeah, they delayed it for a year, and they said that it was, you know, part of it was that, and part of it was it wasn't done, and they needed to do reshoots, and there's always, you know, there's always a million reasons why a movie gets delayed a year, but 9/11 certainly did that movie no favors. I mean, 9/11 delayed or canceled any number of films. We could probably do an entire podcast about what 9/11 did to Hollywood at you know, during that time. And, you know, I think that there is, there's something to be said for Scorsese's willingness to press on in sort of the face of all of this madness, to be immersed in a film that you tried getting going in the 70s and have had on your mind for so long, and to be in production on it, and then to have 9/11 happen, and then to have the movie delayed. It had to have been just, I would love to see, I hope somebody one day writes a book about the making of Gangs of New York, or the documentary or something about what it was like for those 2 years between 2000 and 2002 that this movie was, you know, being worked on in, you know, various forms. And it's such a fascinating movie on so many different levels, because it covers so much, and so much of it is relevant to today. I mean, there's just everything about what they're fighting for, and all of the anger that is going on with Bill the Butcher watching all of the immigrants come off the, you know, off the boat. What's going on right now in Texas and on the border in Mexico? I mean, what do we see in the news, you know, all the time? I mean, like, the problems that they're facing in that movie are still being faced now. And, you know, that's the timeless quality of it. So.
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, you nailed it with everything you just said there. And what's interesting, my last thing I was going to bring up that you spoke about was how the theme of revenge is so prevalent in the film. And that's where not that I don't like it. It has nothing to do with that. I love it, and I love the final confrontation of the fight between the Dead Rabbits and the Confederation of American Natives, and I love that. That's like the greatest. That's the greatest gang name I've ever heard in my entire life. It's all these fucking douchebag New Yorkers led by Day Lewis. Like in that scene when they're towards the end of the film, when they're going to discuss the fight, and Day Lewis is sitting there and he's reading the newspaper and he's smoking his pipe with his top hat and glasses on, and everybody's addressing who they are, and he just puts the paper down. He's like, Confederation of American Natives, and then brings the paper back up to his face. It's so ballsy. I love it. But at the end of the film, when the fight's just about to start, that's when the Navy unloads the cannons onto the city, and everything goes to shit. And the Butcher and Amsterdam are left in the rubble and in the dust, and they both kind of come to at the same time. And they're both looking around, and they're seeing people blown apart, and, you know, the Blue Sash Confederation of American Natives helping the Red Sash Dead Rabbits up, and everybody comes together and they're helping each other, and they're trying to get away from the troops and everything, and from the army that's invading the city. And it's at that moment in the film, and I love it because you can just see it on Day Lewis's face, man. He gets it. You know, he gets it. He gets it. And I believe he even nods to himself when he's watching all this go on. And he doesn't say anything because he doesn't have to, because it's Daniel Day-Lewis. And it's just telegraphed through his body language. And then Amsterdam kills him. And I mean, I love what he says. At least I die a true American. And now I die a true American. It's like balls. It's like, that's your last line of the film. Way to just fucking nail it. But it's does he need to kill him? Does Amsterdam need to kill Bill?
Oh, absolutely. I think that.
You think so?
Well, absolutely. Because I think that, I mean, for a dramatic arc, for a conclusion of your story, for what they've sort of, how they set the character. See, the thing I like about the DiCaprio character is that the DiCaprio character is, you know, another generation removed from his father, who was, you know, just a complete ass kicker along the lines of somebody like Bill the Butcher. Different person, obviously, but you know what I mean? Bill the Butcher and Priest Valen were sort of cut from the same cloth in a way.
Yes, exactly.
And DiCaprio is sort of, you know, he's one step removed from his father. Amsterdam is not his father. He's his father to a certain point, but there's something about him that's different. So I think that while it was harder for DiCaprio's, for Amsterdam to do things and, you know, take a life, I think it was still in him. And I think, I mean, Bill the Butcher even said this, you have that murderous rage in you. I see it. And it's there, but it's not going to be used as willingly or as, you know, it's not as readily available as it is to Bill. Bill's going to, you know, I mean, just look at the way he handles the scene with Brendan Gleeson.
47 years old.
What did you say?
He's 47 years old. You know how I live to be 47 years old?
Oh.
I was just quoting, but yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just, there's the difference between the Amsterdam character, the Priest Valen character, and Bill the Butcher. It's really interesting to compare all three men and sort of look at all of their sides and see the differences and see the similarities. But I do think that it was, you know, it was why he put himself in the positions that he was, you know, putting himself into. He was there to exact revenge for his father. You know, it was. And again, that's just one of the most classic movie devices that there ever could be is, you know, revenge. I mean, you know, I watched you kill my father and, well, guess what? You know, I'm coming for you. And, you know, it also talks about how Bill is secretly vulnerable. Like, he allows this guy into his inner circle that he kind of has an idea about, but doesn't have 100%, you know, knowledge of. And he allows him to get close, and before you know it, he's allowed, you know, death to knock on his door. There's so much good stuff. There's so much classic stuff involved in this film, and that's what I love about it. It feels like a classic, massive Hollywood film made with the edge of the time, and it feels like a film that could really only have been made by Scorsese and really only have come out at the time that it did.
Exactly. But what happens to the 5 points without Bill? You think Amsterdam's going to, like, lead it? No.
No.
But here's the thing, though. It's
that,
like,
that's not for him to do.
Yeah.
I don't think that Amsterdam is a leader the way that Bill is. I think that Amsterdam is more, I think that he represents, again, I think that he represents the new man of the early 1900s. Whereas, you know, the Bill the Butcher and his father was the old guard. And here's this guy that, you know, sees the turn of the century for something different.
Yeah, well, the new guard's a total pussy.
Because, I wouldn't go so far as to call him a total pussy. I mean,
dude,
you know, he does,
I mean,
do
bottom,
a fair amount
bottom
of
line, I mean, bottom line, though, like, the world needs Bill the Butcher. The world needs bad men. I'm just saying. And I don't know. I don't know. That's my take from the ending. I love the ending. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love the fact that Bill the Butcher gets killed by Amsterdam. I love the fact that Bill's blood sprays all over his face and he grabs Amsterdam's hand as he's dying. And you know that Bill wants Amsterdam to kill him.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I mean,
he's the only one that he would allow to kill him.
Exactly, but that's that moment where Bill just realizes everything and everything just comes together in his mind where he realizes that what he's done is not what should have been done. You know what I mean by that?
Mm-hmm.
That his whole
he has a realization that I've taken it too far and I've gone too far and I've overstepped and
look
you know,
what I've
now
done.
It's my time. Yeah, look what I've done.
I know. And I love it. I fucking love Gangs in New York. It's always going to be my, what I call Scorsese's seminal film, seminal masterpiece. It's always going to be that. And I take it with all of its flaws and everything. I don't get mad at anything. I don't hate Cameron Diaz in the movie. She is what she is. My feelings of DiCaprio or whatever, I accept DiCaprio in it. I mean, Gangs in New York wouldn't be Gangs in New York without DiCaprio. I mean, bottom line, even though I think Ferrell would have been perfect for it, I mean, DiCaprio is perfectly suited for what this film turned out to be. Henry Thomas is a bit much, I think. But
yeah.
I don't care for him in this, but whatever. I mean, it's not like he has that big of a part. I do, when I was writing my write-up on it, I kind of laughed at myself when I was talking about the cast and Brendan Gleeson and Liam Neeson and all the great, Jim Broadbent, all the great actors that are in this film, and then John C. Reilly. No. And I just laughed at myself because I thought, remember when John C. Reilly used to be a dramatic actor? Like,
yeah.
Magnolia, Boogie Nights. I mean, he's funny in films, but I mean, Heart
yeah, I
Eight,
him.
All the,
I
all
miss
the
him
Paul Thomas Anderson stuff. Yeah, I do too. I really wish that he would take a dramatic turn again. I miss the John C. Reilly dramatic actor. I know.
While we're on Reilly, and not to digress too much, but because this performance balanced drama and funny in a really good way. Did you see the movie Cyrus?
I didn't, but it crossed my mind as I was talking about Reilly. No, and Cedar Rapids popped into my head, and I started laughing on the inside.
I thought Cedar Rapids was funny. I thought it was tried a little too hard. Cyrus for me was like perfect. And I can't wait for you to see it. Now that I know that you haven't seen it, I'll be all over you now to see Cyrus. John
I know,
C. Reilly
another,
in that movie.
Another movie for you to gangbang me on, I know.
John C. Reilly in that movie is so awkward and funny and dramatic. And he makes you upset.
We need to talk about Kevin. There's dramatic John C. Reilly.
Even though
he's not in the film very much, that came into my head when... I didn't like that movie as much as I wanted to. I was kind of underwhelmed by it.
That movie scared the crap out of me.
I was underwhelmed, man. I don't know.
The scene with the ball rolling, I'll never forget that. With the kid rolling the ball, I will never, ever, ever, ever forget the stare that they got that kid to do. I don't know how they directed that little kid. You know, I think that movie is a slow burn gut punch. So, which I think it had every intention of being. I don't think that movie's intention was to make you feel good. You know, sort of like Gus Van Sant's Elephant, but
that's a fucking goodie.
Yeah,
dude.
I saw that in the theater. I couldn't get out of my seat. I was pinned to my seat for like 10 minutes afterwards. I couldn't get up. I mean, I saw that alone in a mostly empty LA theater, and it was very unnerving movie. But not to digress too much, let's do our top five Daniel Day-Lewis performances, and then, you know, I'm sure we'll cover a little bit more gangs throughout that talk. So you want me to go?
Or
you want me to go?
I don't care. What do you want to do?
I'll go this time.
Okay, you go this time.
So we'll do Daniel Day. My number five is going to be Lincoln. It was just the voice. He's in almost every scene. You went to the movie because he was the center of the show. I mean, honestly, like, what other actor is going to, you know, I mean, who else is going to make you go see a Lincoln movie that's all talking and, you know, isn't any sort of traditional biopic, because that was not. He's just incredible in that film. Number four, Last of the Mohicans. For me, just loved the film. Saw it on the big screen when I was younger. It was a great experience. I can still remember it like it was yesterday, seeing that in the theater. Passionate performance, adventure. Just loved him in that movie. Loved his chemistry with Madeline Stowe. You know, getting a chance to have him work with Michael Mann, you know, it's like two really intense people, you know, making this kick-ass sort of old school action adventure film. And I just love it. The last 20 minutes of that movie break my heart. And I think it's great. I think he's great in it. Number three, Gangs of New York, Bill the Butcher. Incredible. Nobody else, like you said, nobody else that could ever have played the role the way that he did. And that's sort of the recurring theme with him throughout the years. It's just, you know, the few roles that he takes, you really can't sort of picture anybody else. And it's very hard to think of anybody else in that role. Number two, There Will Be Blood. Just an absolutely overwhelming performance with some shades of Bill the Butcher still coming in at numerous points. That movie was just, for me, just a huge, huge, just this, again, an overwhelming film. Very, again, sort of parallels to Gangs of New York in how you need to watch it a few times and it needs to settle in and there's a lot going on. And his performance in that movie is electric. The just like in Gangs, every single line of dialogue was given was perfect. And it's just a method acting masterclass of just watching this guy and, you know, just this, the ultimate greed, the ultimate study of greed. And I loved it. But just without a question, I mean, I didn't really even need to think about my number one. My Left Foot, just absolutely, to be honest with you, man, like when I was younger and, you know, more stupid than I am now, even, you know, you're making fun of people because they got problems. You're stupid. You're a young kid. That movie made me stop making fun of people. Honestly, like I remember my dad showing me that one when I was younger and it blew me away. And I've seen it throughout the years a bunch of times, and My Left Foot will just be one of those movies that, you know, if you're ever having a bad day, if you're ever thinking like you're depressed or you got a problem, you know, I know that people have severe problems, obviously, but think about that movie. Think about Chrissy Brown. Think about what it was like to go through his life the way that he did. Daniel Day-Lewis's performance in that movie is just, it's something else. I can't say enough good things about that film in general. I think it is just a beautiful movie about love, about family, about hope. And his performance, just it goes without saying. I mean, from sneaking in the flask with the straw and, you know, getting a chance to curse and the whole, just, I love the movie. I think it's just a great film. And for me, it was very easy to come up with my number one. That movie honestly opened my eyes when I was a younger person. It like sort of changed my outlook on people. So yeah, that's my top five, Daniel Day.
Who's your number one of all time actor?
You know something? It's like, that's a great question. I really wouldn't be able to answer right off the cuff the way that you did with saying Daniel Day-Lewis is your number one actor. He's certainly up there for me. I really don't know who my number one actor would be. I'd have to think about it without making any
okay.
sort
I was
of,
just
yeah.
I was just wondering.
It's a great question. I mean, there's been people who I love watching all
just,
of their
just throw some names off the top of your head.
Off the top of my head, I mean, to be honest with you, I've loved everything that Brad Pitt has been in, and I love the quality of the material that he's always been attracted to. Daniel Day-Lewis has never given a bad performance, and he's been in some of the best movies of my lifetime. I'd have to really think about it. It's a good question.
All right, cool.
We could have a podcast of our favorite people.
All right, right on. Without any further ado, my top five, Daniel Day-Lewis was hard, man. It was like harder than my Jeff Bridges top five. My number five is going to be The Ballad of Jack and Rose, which is a movie he made between There Will Be Blood and Gangs of New York. It was a movie his wife wrote and directed, and she's the daughter of Arthur Miller, who he starred in The Crucible, which was written by Arthur Miller, the American playwright. I loved his performance in that film. He was just so haunting, and it gets very dark with the emotional themes of living on the commune with his daughter, and they're the only two people left on the commune, and it's just very...
It's an emotionally creepy film.
Yeah, man. I mean, geez. But, yeah, I mean, I don't think the film is as good as it should have been, but I think Day-Lewis gives a fantastic performance. He's fantastic in everything I've ever seen him in. I mean, honestly, when even going back to Gandhi and the Bounty, I mean, the guy's always been on fire. All right, so then my number two is a tie between In the Name of the Father and The Boxer, the second and third hopefully not final, film that reunited Day-Lewis with Jim Sheridan, who also directed My Left Foot. I love both of those films. I saw both those films when they came out, and I was way young when I saw In the Name of the Father, and I didn't really grasp it. But now I own both of them, and I love it. I love The Boxer, the movie set in Ireland with him as the title character of The Boxer, but also dealing with a lot of the IRA issues at that time. It was a contemporary movie.
It's an awesome film. It's so underrated. Didn't that movie not do well in America?
No, it didn't. I don't think it gained any press. I don't know if Emily Watson was nominated for anything, maybe Best Supporting Actress. I could be completely off base there. Maybe it was a Golden Globe or something. But I know the movie wasn't received very well, but I love it. I mean, of course I love it. He gives a staple Daniel Day-Lewis great performance. All right, my third one I'm probably going to catch shit for, because I know a lot of people hate this movie, but I enjoyed the movie, and I really enjoyed Day-Lewis in it, is Nine, the Rob Marshall film. I loved it, and I loved the audacity of putting Daniel Day-Lewis in a musical where he actually sang. He didn't sing as much as the rest of the cast. I think he had two songs where he sang. But of course he can do it, and of course he can nail it. And of course it's this awesome riff on 8 1/2 and the nine women that make up Guido Contini's life. I really liked the film. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it immensely. I own it on Blu-ray. I owned it on DVD. I double-dipped on that one, actually. But I think that film and Day-Lewis's performance in it shows that the guy can do anything. I mean, he's been in a musical. He's been in Gangs of New York. He's been in The Boxer. He's been in Age of Innocence. He's been in, you know, I think every genre, aside from maybe horror and sci-fi, which I don't know if he'd ever make a horror or sci-fi film, but you could argue that his performance in There Will Be Blood is a horror performance. I mean, it's terrifying.
And I gotta say, I'll jump in real too. I love it.
Go ahead.
I thought not.
Yeah, man, it's awesome. You know, everybody fucking bags on music.
It's a gorgeous looking movie. It's beautiful. It's entertaining. It's sexy. He's great in it. Penelope Cruz, Get Out of Town. I mean,
right. The whole cast is great. I even love Kate Hudson in that movie.
It's not as good as 8 1/2, but no movie is going to be as good as 8 1/2.
Even Fergie's awesome in it.
It played to Rob Marshall's strengths as a filmmaker, in my opinion. So I like the movie a lot more than most people did. I saw it in the theater. I have yet to get it on Blu-ray for some inane reason, but I will change that.
I think it's really cheap.
Yeah.
I think it's really cheap. And not to digress too much from my top five list, but I wanted to say prior, and I forgot that, and I was going to say this earlier, but I love all the stories about Daniel Day-Lewis that's recounted from the actors and directors and the crew from each film he's in, where he just immerses himself.
And he leaves an impression on everybody.
Right. Inside the character, and he won't come out of that character until the production's wrapped. Like, I read a great interview with John C. Reilly, where he spoke about him playing Bill the Butcher in Gangs of New York, where he would just stay inside of his trailer and listen to Eminem as loud as he possibly could to get all fucking jazzed up and full of rage to go out and shoot the scene. Or
that's awesome.
when Michael Mann recounts casting him in Last of the Mohicans and said that Daniel Day-Lewis just went off into the wilderness for months to get into preparation for the film and lived on his own and foraged for food and hunted and stuff. I mean, who does that? Honestly.
Nobody.
I mean, why don't... It comes down to like that great Laurence Olivier line to Dustin Hoffman when they were making Marathon Man, where Laurence Olivier said to Dustin Hoffman, "Why don't you just act? It would be so much easier." You know, I love it. But, I mean, that's who Daniel Day-Lewis is, and that's why the guy only has, what, 15 movies on his filmography, and he's almost 60. I mean, it obviously takes a lot out of him. Okay, so moving on to my number two. My number two is Lincoln. Who the fuck's going to play Abraham Lincoln? Honestly, I know Liam Neeson was attached to the project for a long time. Liam Neeson would have been great. I mean, he would have been a great Abraham Lincoln. But when the casting announcement broke that Daniel Day-Lewis was going to play Abraham Lincoln in a Steven Spielberg-directed movie, and then Tommy Lee Jones is going to play Thaddeus Stevens, and Sally Field is going to play Mary Todd. Like, get the fuck out of here, honestly. I mean, you knew right away that this movie was going to be something special, and I loved when the first trailer came out, and there was the voiceover from Daniel Day-Lewis, and nobody was sure, like, is that really the way Abraham, is that Abraham Lincoln talking? Why does he sound high-pitched and nasally? And there was this shit fit that everybody threw about the voice in Lincoln. It's like, get fucked. If Steven Spielberg and Daniel Day-Lewis are doing this, you know it's authentic, and you know they did their research. I mean, Jesus.
I saw that movie twice in the theater. I love it. I thought it was fantastic.
I did, too. It was funny. I went out to dinner with my mom prior to recording, and we were talking about, like, my top five Meryl Streep and Day-Lewis, and we were talking about my mom loves Abraham Lincoln and loves American history, and she was all excited to go see that film, and we went to go see it in theaters the opening night. And the opening scene, my mom was in tears when Lincoln's talking to the black soldier, and the black soldier recites the Gettysburg Address to Lincoln and walks off. I mean, my mom was just crying within the first 5 minutes of the film. It was great. And I love the fact they don't show the assassination in the film. I think it's more powerful with the ending that it has than had they have shown the assassination with him just walking clumsily, bumbling down the hallway.
I still wanted the movie to end on that last shot of him walking out of the White House where it's like green outside because maybe it was going to rain or something. There's this amazing quality of light pouring through that glass structure. And I always felt that while I do agree with you, I think if you were going to show the assassination, why not show it? Why not do it differently than what you did? Like he subverts your expectation. You know what I mean? So that I always like, but I still wanted that movie to end on that last shot of him walking out, because then after he gets assassinated, you have that quick fade back to him talking because he didn't want the movie to end with him laying there dead. Like he wanted you to see one more moment of triumph. So I sort of felt call it quits when he's walking out triumphant after, you know, saving, you know, after, you know, doing what it was that he wanted to do. But in any event, small quibble, really awesome film, and he's unbelievable. And like you said, no one could play Abraham Lincoln.
Right. And then my number one, obviously, is a three-way tie because I couldn't make up my fucking mind about where I was going to place these three performances. So we're just going to go alphabetically for my number one three-way tie. Obviously, Gangs of New York. I mean, that's a performance that stuck with me forever. I think it's one of the most fantastical spectacles I've ever seen on screen. Just his matted down greasy hair and that mustache and the glass eye that has the eagle on it. Of course his glass eye. Of course he's going to have a glass eye. And of course it's going to have an eagle on it. Because that fucking guy is the Iron Patriot. For good or bad, that guy's the Iron Patriot. I mean, and his costume design and his top hats and always messing with knives, and the scene where he's throwing the knives at Cameron Diaz, and then the scene where he flips the cleaver up in the air when DiCaprio's down on the table and it lands next to DiCaprio's head. There's something so scary about his performance, but at the same time, the frightening performance of Day-Lewis is blended with his vulnerability that you were talking about, that he shows to Amsterdam and towards the end of the film when he lets Amsterdam kill him. So that's my number one. My second number one, My Left Foot, duh. I mean, jeez. Every time I watch that film, I am completely enamored with his performance, and I just can't even believe that's an actor that's acting that out. He leaves me speechless, man, with every performance. And I mean, I've said this many times throughout the podcast, but Living or Dead, I think this guy's the greatest actor, and he's truly something special and so unique. Every time you see him on screen, it's something brand new.
Yeah, I agree and with everything reaches, you're saying reaches, about him. You know, it's tough to deny his. It's tough to deny the overwhelming nature of his caliber.
I just can't imagine how this guy functions, and I can only imagine that the only way he's able to sustain or function in life is to be able to use acting as an outlet. I mean, or vice versa. It's just this interesting ebb and flow or balance
within
himself.
Everything seems
to
come from so deep within.
Yeah, I mean, each performance is different. I mean, I obviously there's a comparison between Gangs of New York and There Will Be Blood, but I think those, as much as there is a similarity, I think that those two characters are on opposite ends of the spectrum, and with every performance that he gives, it's as if he's reaching into a different part of himself to showcase something new. It's completely unique and original every time I see it. So then, obviously, my last part of my three-way tie of his number one performances is There Will Be Blood. Holy fuck. I mean, what? He doesn't talk for the first 30 minutes of the film. It's just him. It's just him mining by himself, and then, you know, the cave collapsing or his mind collapsing, and then that film spans to that epic scope where he's just introverted throughout the entire film. Doesn't say very much. He, you know, there's you get a few glimmers of the rage when, you know, he's going to shoot that guy that's pretending, or when he shoots the guy that's pretending to be his brother. And there's a couple other small scenes, but that ending has one of the best endings to a film I've ever seen, where it's the sad old man that built this empire and has nothing whatsoever to show for it except money, which doesn't matter at all. The whole I drink your milkshake is one of the greatest things I've ever seen. And poor Paul Dano, you know, and fuck Paul Dano, not even poor Paul Dano. I honestly think that Paul Dano, Eli Sunday, is the film's villain.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, he's a joke. He's a fraud.
He's worse than Daniel Plainview, and Daniel Plainview's a bad person. But I mean, can you think of too many films where the main character is the villain? I can't think of too many. I mean, Godfather 2, maybe.
Outside of Nightcrawler, there hasn't been too many recently. I mean,
Nightcrawler's definitely a goodie for that. Yes.
But yeah, no. I mean the.
But I mean, isn't the end of that film satisfying? As fucked up as that sounds.
Oh yeah.
When he just takes down Eli Sunday and just completely breaks him and then smashes his fucking head with the bowling pin.
Yeah, I've never seen that movie as Daniel Plainview as the villain. I've always seen it as Sunday as the evil one. I mean, I'm sorry. I've always seen Plainview as evil. I never saw him as the villain. I just saw him as an anti-hero, as someone who was fucked up. But at the same time, the way that movie ends is fully satisfying because I fucking couldn't stand Paul. I mean, I love Paul Dano in the film as an actor. He did a great performance, but I wanted to beat the living shit out of him every time he opened his sniveling little mouth. I mean, it's like you just want to kick shit out of him.
It's so satisfying, and that's why I think that film's genius is how everything kind of turns on a dime with when he takes down Eli Sunday. It's just like it's like redemption. It's like this is the last thing the guy had to live for, and it finally happened, and it's like almost as if Daniel Plainview gets solace from it, which I think, not even as if he does, I think he does get solace from that. And the audience should too, and that's why I think that not a lot of people like that film. Well, I think there's a lot of reasons people don't like that film, but I think that that ending definitely is startling to your average, you know, moviegoer that thinks Forrest Gump's the best movie ever made. Not that Forrest Gump's not a great movie, but I'm just saying with that. So yeah, that's my DDL top five, man. I had to throw a bunch of ties in there. I felt like you when you were doing your Brad Pitt one. So
and go, yeah, I mean, go. and my runner-up would be probably The Age of Innocence, which is one that I've only seen like 1.5 times, and I don't
think Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Yeah,
I mean that's fucking goody too.
It's tough to come up with five, but I got to see Age of Innocence again. I can't believe there's no Blu-ray for that movie.
How is Twilight or Criterion not put that out? I'm shocked that no one's put that out.
Yeah, I don't understand what somebody's waiting for. How Criterion hasn't done that? You're right. So, well, top five, Meryl Streep, who obviously would many consider to be, you know, the male equivalent, quote unquote, of Daniel Day-Lewis, whatever that's worth. Number five might surprise people, but I just really enjoyed the movie It's Complicated. I thought it was extremely enjoyable. I thought it was funny. I thought she was great in it. I loved Alec Baldwin in that movie. He made me laugh so much. I loved all the relationship stuff. I'm sort of, I mean, not even sort of a fan. I'm a fan of Nancy Meyers. I like her movies. I think that she does exactly what she sets out to do, and she always makes a classy-looking film that always has some funny stuff in it, and, you know, it's always lightweight, but with a little bit of, you know, heart and a little bit of smarts and a little bit of cheesiness thrown in. But I really enjoyed that movie. It was just a fun film, and I thought she was really good in it. And I love, the chemistry she had with Alec Baldwin was terrific. I loved it. Number four, The Deer Hunter. Everybody in The Deer Hunter is incredible, and it's just one of those movies that, you know, it's just such an overwhelmingly emotional film, and the last scene of that movie is haunting, and it's something that you'll never forget. And an early performance from her that just has stuck out over the years with me is something that, you know, I'll never forget. Number three, for me, is Doubt. I thought that she did an incredible job in that film, making me want to absolutely tear her apart for the entire movie. I really just wanted to crawl into the movie and just throw her around, because she's just so needling in that movie, and she's so
terrible.
Yeah, it's such a great performance, and I think that movie is really awesome. And like the way Roger Deakins shot it, I love the cinematography in that movie, the way that it brings you psychologically into everybody's, you know, headspace. And I thought that she was just blisteringly bitchy, and
you don't
just
feel
awesome
bad for her at the end, or is it harsh? It's like. Or it's just like the hatred's just too much at that point where you just don't care.
I think that there's probably some, like, maybe there's probably some sort of, like, you know, general sympathy or empathy that you might feel. But there's this, she's too hardcore of a bitch for so long in that movie to, you know, all of a sudden flip on a dime. That movie, I think, is very, very loaded thematically. And I think it's just... I think it's a great movie. I
agree.
I got to watch it again. In fact, there's not much that I don't remember from it, but it's just one of those movies that I remember loving when I saw it. Number two for me is Spike Jonze's adaptation. Love that movie, and her performance in it is different. It's weird. It's quirky. It's funny. It's oddly sexy in a way at times. Which I don't often say about Meryl Streep, it's just such a unique film, and I've loved it for years, and I come back to it once a year, and her role in that movie is just incredible. And my number one, without a doubt, and it's just a film that I've only seen it once, and I remember every single thing from it, and I got to watch it again at some point, but it's just a tough one. But Sophie's Choice for me, that movie, I saw it when I was in college, my sophomore year. I saw it in the screening library of Keene State College, and it blew me away. It absolutely blew me away. It stuck with me for weeks. Just everything about that movie, Pakula's direction, everything. Just, it's one of those films that if you haven't seen it, you need to see it once, and you won't forget it. It is the true definition of unforgettable. And for me it was sort of similar to Daniel Day-Lewis going away. I knew that it would be Sophie's Choice in my left foot for both of them. So that's my top five.
I think the Shout Factory just put out Sophie's Choice on Blu-ray. Somebody just put it out on Blu-ray. And I own the DVD, and I thought about buying the Blu-ray, but I've only seen that movie once. And I think that that's a movie you only need to see once.
Yeah, it's
not
one
that,
of those...
Not that you shouldn't... Not that it's not good enough for you to rewatch it. I think it's fantastic. I think it's a fantastic film.
You got to be in the right headspace to watch that film.
I mean, well, what's your headspace to watch Sophie's Choice? Because I think before going into seeing the film, and I only saw that film probably 5 years ago, I knew what the choice was, but I didn't know what the ending was.
Gotcha.
And the ending is like that extra kick in the face.
I know. It's like after all that. Really?
That poor woman. But then Kevin Kline in that movie.
Yeah, I was going to say
Kevin Kline's like almost just as good as she is, and I love how that character, the build to that character and what that character is, you know, and Peter McNichol's awesome in it. I mean, that movie's a one of a kind, man.
Alan Pakula really did not mess around. I'm a huge fan of his body of work, but
I am too. All right, my top five, I'm going to go with my number five is One True Thing. It was a small film that came out. I think it was late. Yeah, it was mid to late 90s with William Hurt and Renee Zellweger, and I forgot the guy that plays the brother. But it's where she's terminal and she's dying of cancer, and Renee Zellweger comes home for it, and William Hurt's the stoic, introverted father that is dealing with the grief of it in his own way, and Renee Zellweger's trying to come to terms with the death of her amazing mother, played by the amazing Meryl Streep. I just thought it was a very touching film, and of course she was nominated for it, along with every other thing she's been in. I just really enjoyed that film, and I haven't seen it for a while, but it's always stuck with me.
Very good
movie.
It's
one of her best performances, and... I needed to put it on my list because I think that's a film probably most people have not seen, but it's very good. My number four is a tie between Lions for Lambs and Doubt. And they're two very different performances. The Lions for Lamb performance is smaller than the Doubt one. But I love Lions for Lambs. I think that's one of Redford's best films, and I think it's vastly underrated, and as heavy-handed as it is with its message, I still love it. And I think that that film also showcases Tom Cruise's last great dramatic performance. But
I agree.
I love her. I love her as the journalist who's pressing Tom Cruise for answers. And Tom Cruise thinks he can just smile through the interview and keep repeating America, 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 patriotism, patriotism, patriotism. And she won't accept it, and she keeps pressing him for more and more and more until Tom Cruise just loses it on her, and then it causes her to, you know, question journalism and what journalism has become in the modern age. It's great. I love her in it. And then Doubt, I can't say anything more about Doubt than what you said. She's just fucking terrible in that movie. You just want to strangle her throughout the entire movie until the end where she has her quote-unquote confession with Amy Adams, and you still, I don't know, I don't even know if I empathize with her. I mean, I guess I sure as shit don't sympathize with her, and the fact that you're forced to empathize with her is like a dirty trick. Because you don't want to, but you do. It's brilliant filmmaking, and it's brilliant writing, and it's a bit brilliant performances. I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Amy Adams, love the film. My number three, and I cheated all over the place with my two top five lists. My number three was almost a four-way tie, but it's going to be a three-way tie between Silkwood, The Deer Hunter, and Kramer versus Kramer. I think all those performances go hand in hand. I almost threw Ironweed in there, too, because that's all around the same time frame. But I think she's great in all three of those. Silkwood's just a tour de force performance by her. I mean, she's fantastic in that movie. The Deer Hunter, yes. I mean, that movie's haunting as fuck. And, you know, when I think about it, the funny thing about The Deer Hunter is I've probably seen it two or three times all the way through. And then when I'm in the mood to be like, all right, let's watch The Deer Hunter. We haven't watched it, or I haven't watched it in a while. I'll put it in, and I'll get to the 40-minute mark where they're in Vietnam, and then I'm just kind of like, no. I'm good. I like the first 40 minutes when they're celebrating Christopher Walken's wedding and John Savage wedding.
I'm about to embark on a revisit of the entire film coming up in the next probably month or so. So.
Oh God. Yep. I think Criterion's going to put that out on Blu-ray.
They've been rumored to do it, but I couldn't.
Criterion puts that out on Blu-ray. I'm going to watch it in one sitting, and it's going to be rough because I love how Criterion just has to put those movies out, like Antichrist. It's like, how many times can you sit through Antichrist? Yeah. I sit through it twice, and then every time I watch Antichrist, I probably turn it off 20 minutes later because it's like, I'm not doing it to myself. Not going through this with Yvonne Trier. Yeah. Not doing it.
I'm surprised they haven't put out Irreversible.
Right. I have the DVD of that. God, I watched that. Man, we watched that in film school. And then it was aesthetics of filmmaking, and the instructor's like, "All right, we're gonna watch Irreversible today." Like, I've never even heard of this, and then it's just like, "Oh my, really? Okay, I'm just gonna buy it."
It's the only movie I can't watch again.
It's so awesome, though.
Can't do it.
It's so good.
I can't do it. I saw it in the theater. I saw it in the theater where he had you know how he put a low-level droning sound on the soundtrack to fuck with you? When it was in the theater, he asked the theater owners, he sent a letter you know how sometimes filmmakers send letters to theater owners, like, would you please run it like this? He asked them to specifically run some sort of, you can look it up. He asked people to specifically run the sound in a way to heighten that low-level decibel sound. Dude, I'm telling you, I've never seen more people walk out of a movie in my entire life than that one. I sat through the whole thing on that one.
Were you the last person left by the end of the film?
Me and the two people I were with were three of the last people in there. I mean, there was probably 10 people left. It wasn't sold out or anything, but easily 10 or 15 people left in that movie. I can't watch it again. Not to interrupt you. Go ahead with your list.
No, you're good. And then Kramer versus Kramer. I didn't watch that movie till about maybe a year ago because my buddy Peyton was up my ass about watching that movie, and I didn't watch it because that's what won the Oscar over all that jazz, and I refused. And Hoffman won the Oscar over Roy Scheider, and I refused to believe that movie could be better than all that jazz, which it's not. And Dustin Hoffman's not better than Roy Scheider, but it's a very good movie, and I really enjoyed it. So my number two is The Iron Lady. I love that movie. I think that she gives one of the greatest performances I've ever seen in that movie. It's interesting. Margaret Thatcher is a controversial character, a controversial person when it comes to contemporary world politics. I think she's very fascinating. That movie made me want to learn a lot about Margaret Thatcher. I didn't really change my opinion on her one way or the other after learning more about her, but I love the film. I thought it was a very good film. I don't know why it got such bad reviews, but I think that showcased Streep's range as an actress very well. I love that film. And then obviously my number one, Sophie's Choice, that poor woman. Oh my God. And that performance is incredible from everything about it to the way she physically changes throughout the film, and particularly how her accent changes as the film progresses through time and where she is in the world. I think that is just an unbelievable showcase of a talent for an actor. But like you said, man, I said when you talked about it, I've only seen that film once, and that's not something I don't know if I'd ever revisit it. I mean, maybe if I were watching it with somebody and they hadn't seen it before, I'd be like, you gotta
yeah, it's a movie
this.
To watch when someone hasn't seen it, just so you can talk about it, and you know, it's tough. It's a tough one.
Right. So that's my top five Streep.
Nice. So,
yeah.
Well, anything else you want to bring up, or think we're good? I would love to also just quickly just have a quick shout out to Mark Pellington. Thank you again, Mark, for coming on the show. If you're listening to this one, it was a blast. We had a great time, and anytime that you'd like to come back and talk about anything, we'd love to have you back on. So we'll be
obviously open door invitation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're running a little long. We can talk about our Blu-rays that I haven't really bought too much.
This was
my Lifetime labels, and I got True Detective, which apparently the U.S. Postal Service or Target is still holding your. Well, just real quick, I'll plug it. Target released an exclusive steelbook of the Blu-ray of the first season of True Detective with exclusive cover art by Mondo. And it's great, and this is my first time watching it on Blu-ray. I'm glad I never bought it before. I just always watched it on HBO Go or whenever it was on HBO, but the Blu-ray picture is pristine. I mean, I've probably watched the show at least five times all the way through since it's only 8 hours, and you can kind of bang it out in one day if you're ambitious enough or over a couple of days. But, yeah, I think that's a must-own for anyone. But aside from that, I really didn't get too much. I got the Twilight Time labels of Zardoz and Night of the Generals, which I'm really looking forward to revisiting this weekend. I don't know if I'm going to have time because I blocked off some time tomorrow to do some writing on my novel. And then Nick has a list of stuff for me to watch this weekend that I need to pound out. So just to get him off my ass about it. So, which, you know, I'm really looking forward to seeing the titles that you wanted me to watch. So I'm going to get those out of the way this weekend. But aside from that, what are we going to be doing next week?
Yeah, next week I'm really excited. We're going to do Brian De Palma's Femme Fatale, which is one of my absolute favorite. I've loved Brian De Palma movies, and that's one of my absolute favorites, if not my favorite. I have to really take a look at his list again.
Really?
Oh yeah, it's pure Brian De Palma.
See, because I haven't seen it, and I love De Palma, and I own a bunch of his stuff, I rewatched Dress to Kill and Blowout.
Listen, Blowout, Body Double, Dress to Kill,
Snake
The Untouchables,
Eyes,
Snake Eyes. Listen, I love Brian De Palma's work. I have for years. I'm an apologist. Even his crap movies have cool sequences or something neat, something interesting going on. Femme Fatale is, as you would say, it's his Bob Fosse movie. It's pure filmmaking. It's pure undiluted Brian De Palma. It's all of his obsessions. It's his domino. It's his it's his ultimate artistic expression of all of the things that he loves about cinema, about women, about noir, about Europe. Can't wait for you to see it. I saw it twice in the theater. The movie completely bombed. A very, very divisive, mix of reviews. You got Ebert and Manola Dargis, you know, who absolutely flipped. You got people saying it's terrible. I can't wait for you to see it. I think it's just amazing. We're going to do top five performances from Antonio Banderas, who is featured in Femme Fatale. And in a little bit of a twist on the format, we are going to do our top five favorite Femme Fatale performances from any movie. So we'll have five. You could have five actresses. You could pick more than one if an actress did, you know, two femme fatale roles in her career. But
this is going to get fun.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. So we will highlight some really good movies. And I already kind of know who I'm going to pick, so I'm going to have a lot of fun with this one. So, yeah.
I got my work cut out for me. You just sprung that on me. So this is going to be awesome. I'm going to have to.
I'm going to have to get into some noir this week.
Yeah. Well, awesome,
stuff.
Man.
Great episode, man. Yeah. Thanks everybody for listening and. We'll be back, with our regular episode next week, and maybe something else before that. We'll keep you posted.
Awesome. Sounds good. Thanks everybody for listening.